Spirituality Challenged is a podcast recorded on Canadian Treaty 1 territory, and that the land on which we gather is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene people, and the homeland of the Métis Nation. We acknowledge that our water is sourced from Shoal Lake 41st Nation, which is located on Treaty 3 territory. Spirituality Challenged respects the spirit and intent of treaties and treaty making and are open to future partnerships with First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people in the spirit of truth, reconciliation, and collaboration. Welcome to Spirituality Challenge, dear listener. I'm your host, Aaron Parsons. On this podcast, we uncover the rarely discussed history and expose sources behind controversial Christian ideologies while speaking truth to power. We try to cover as much ground within an hour on one topic in each episode, so sit back, relax, and prepare to be challenged. Now we're going to jump right in. This episode was originally going to be about environmentalism, but I was having a ton of trouble writing specifically about things like global warming and the history of anti-scientific ideas. So I shifted the focus to why evangelicals like to endlessly consume pleasures while claiming they don't conform to the pattern of this world. Hopefully we can touch more on the original topic in a future episode, but for now, let's do a quick review from episode 4 of how the consumerist values in evangelicalism were formed between the Industrial Revolution and the end of the Second World War. So we're going to back up to a time when preachers like Charles Fox Parham, Smith Wigglesworth, and Amy Semple McPherson preached about money in a time of two world wars, the Roaring Twenties, and the Great Depression. Now, during this time, American culture was trying to figure out if religious solutions would be beneficial for the economy. Christians wanted holy sanction over what was owned, but some believers weren't satisfied with what they currently had. So they had faith that when they got what they wanted, they'll be satisfied. And when you're not satisfied with what you have, you'll never be satisfied with what you want. This was where the religious language of desire started to take root in early fundamentalism. There was a kind of peace that religious individuals were searching for. It was a peace where God had control over both the supernatural and the mundane. It was also a time from 1910 to 1940 where everyone wondered, what would Jesus do when it came to the rich and the poor wealth gap? How much money would the Salvation Army give to the poor in growing urban areas? Would what was known as the social gospel solve this particular problem as well? Back then, some Christians still believed thoughts and prayers were the answer to out-of-control industrialism. And of course, others were on the fence. But because of this hope that God will keep believers out of poverty, much of the population that was religiously associated with Christianity, they were thinking of American riches. This was because people needed pastors who will preach about riches, like Russell Conwell, who gave a famous sermon called Acres of Diamonds. Preachers like Conwell pushed the idea that believers had to accept their Christian duty to work hard and see God's hand through the workings of capitalism. Conwell used the Calvinist theology he grew up with to craft his teachings of manifested wealth that came from a so-called growing economy. He preached that riches indicated virtue and poverty was sin. He preached the American virtues of resilience, innovation, and pragmatism as the way out of financial struggle. Millionaires and billionaires were eating this up, and they helped their pastors make finances a moral class issue. Combining this with New Thought and pop psychology, the most popular Christian gospels eventually became synonymous with prosperity and soon consumption. The This gospel of wealth sized up large combinations of big businesses, consumerism, and new wealth as blessings of the business world rewarded the richest entrepreneurs at the time. Churches modeled these big businesses while congregations turned to a gospel that taught how capitalism, the Protestant work ethic, wealth, and devotion worked together to manifest blessings in the life of the proletariat. Sadly, the Great Depression had many congregants doubt if this gospel of wealth could work amongst economic collapse. Despite the struggle being so real, many followers were still attracted to Billy Sunday, Dale Carnegie, and Napoleon Hill as they published books and sermons to help anyone achieve the good life. Results fluctuated amongst congregants, but most of the flock of sheep stuck it out with the shepherds. Christianity and commerce became one after World War II as believers read their own religious fortunes based on how the times changed. Suburbanization became a defining feature of post-war time, with families moving to the suburbs and experiencing a higher standard of living. Television sets in dining room and living rooms played a crucial role in allowing the dissemination of messages on a large scale in the 50s. And using the TV, new products were advertised for housewives to buy, while also advertising sporting goods, comics, and candy for kids, along with new appliances for yard work for men. The dramatic economic prosperity contributed to a consumer-driven culture that impacted values and priorities. The consumerism of the 50s opened up new avenues for self-help, early success literature, and pop psychology, and they all presented different sets of tools to solve today's problems. There was also the need to be powerful, influential, and rich, and it became a consumable product from God to the believer through meditation, prayer, the power of suggestion, or placebos. And in order to consume the blessings God gave his followers, Christians had to use their new thought manifesting, quote unquote, to activate the divine's hidden powers. This turned Christian notions of spirituality into a tool for achieving great wealth and other forms of success, including relationships. Televangelists and religious programs used television as a platform to reach broad audiences with this crazy form of thinking, which contributed to the commodification of religious messages. The post-war capitalism of this time also bled into consumerism, which then influenced the production and sale of religious products. From books and records to religious merchandise, there was a commercialization of Christian symbols and teachings. The consumer-driven culture also influenced individual values within Christian communities. Emphasis on personal success and material gain sometimes overshadowed traditional Christian values of humility and selflessness, values that are actually held by much smaller churches who believed it was easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for rich people to enter the kingdom of God. Much of these changes in Christianity during the 50s weren't universally accepted. And while many American Christians loved the merging of consumer culture and religious practice, a lot of churches outside of the United States and Canada expressed concerns about the spiritual principles that were watered down in exchange for the pursuit of material gain. As we've mentioned in previous episodes, the civil rights movement of the 1960s challenged societal norms and sparked a broader reevaluation of Christian values. The discussions about justice, equality, and individual rights influenced the broader cultural landscape, especially during the time of Malcolm X and the progressive Christian Martin Luther King Jr. It was recently discovered that one huge fundamentalist had this to say about a Christian college's celebration of King in a letter to the Scott Memorial Baptist Church in San Diego.
Dear sir, recently this report came into my hands, and I find it very difficult to believe. It seems incredible that a Christian college could participate in honoring an outright theological liberal heretic whose nonviolent demonstrations have resulted in the deaths of 17 people. As a pastor, I'm asked every year by parents and prospective students to express my sentiments of Wheaton College. In all fairness, I would like to know if this article accurately describes the fact. I would be quite delighted if you say no. Sincerely yours, Pastor Tim F. LaHaye.
In 1968, Tim LaHaye was very upset with the civil rights movement, which came about after centuries of slavery, followed by a century of Jim Crow laws, and many thousands of lynchings were experienced by black folks. LaHaye wrote this letter, drawing the line at 17 deaths he recognized as something that mattered, in the same year that MLK died, of course. LaHaye went on to write the Left Behind book series, loved by raptured, obsessed evangelicals, who made the author a millionaire many times over for his futuristic interpretation of Jewish apocalyptic literature. Now, this next part is going to be a personal theory that I came up with, dear listener, so please feel free to do some extra research from credible sources after listening. Because what I'm about to tell you may actually contain some of my personal bias towards how Christians, obsessed with the end of the world, still consume so much. Now, I have a theory that eschatology has a lot to do with Christian consumerism. Eschatology is the theological study of the end times. The interest in end-of-the-world themes among certain Christian groups, especially Pentecostals and NAR folks, had implications for their views on the material world and consumption. Many American Christians believe in a premillennial rapture, where believers would be taken up to heaven before a period of tribulation on earth. In other words, Christians will be gone before the largest shit hits the fan. Christians still held onto the idea of material wealth and financial success, with those beliefs somehow becoming intertwined with belief that Jesus is coming back to earth within our lifetimes. This alignment contributed to a mindset that viewed material wealth as a potential indicator of spiritual standing, which according to Christians shows non-believers they can enjoy heaven on earth before the earth is completely destroyed. Now, I just want to note quickly here that only certain groups of Christians embrace this insane, unhinged perspective. Beliefs about the end of the world and Christian connection to consumerism are actually only a thing in a few evangelical and fundamentalist circles. There are many other Christian denominations and traditions that have different theological perspectives on the end times and the Book of Revelation. And before I accidentally overlook this fun fact, here it is. There are four ways to interpret Revelation. One way is preterism, which interprets Revelation as largely fulfilled in the past, often associating events with the early history of Christianity or the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. I actually held on to this belief from the end of 2011 until I deconverted. Another way is historicism, which views Revelation as a timeline of historical events with symbols representing different periods in history, including the rise and fall of empires like the Roman or Chinese empires. Then there's idealism, that takes a symbolic approach, seeing Revelation as conveying timeless spiritual truths rather than predicting specific historical events. This interpretation is less concerned with chronological order that happens in the book. And then, of course, there's the batshit crazy futurists that we all know and love, who expect most of the events in Revelation to occur in the future, often associated with end-time scenarios such as the second coming of Christ and the final judgment along with the rapture. These are the people, I believe, who will most likely consume as much of the world as possible. They'll be polluting the air with their cars, eating a ton of Chick-fil-A food, and littering their red paper coffee cups that they were so-called blessed with at Starbucks. Despite all that, I'm aware that most non-futuristic crowd of Bible readers of Revelation often maintain a more nuanced approach to material wealth and success in relation to the end times and the Book of Revelation. But what eschatology, particularly within the context of dispensationalist thought, did to contribute to certain Christian views on consumerism during the 80s was to shape the understanding of the relationship between material prosperity and spiritual beliefs. And because Tim LaHaye gave a vision of how the world will be judged soon, futuristic Christians probably subconsciously think, oh hey, I'm going to get raptured anyway, and Jesus took my sin on the cross so I can consume, go on cruises, drive my car down the West Coast, fly around the world, stop recycling, let the landfills rise, create a ton of fossil fuels, kill a bunch of animals, and then ask God for forgiveness because he's going to cleanse the world and the messes I made anyway. Let's be honest. That was not the Christianity that I grew up with when I was a kid. And when people implied this kind of thing, I wasn't friends with them for very long. Now you're probably saying, you grew up in privilege, Aaron. Why are you talking about this? Look, you don't even know me. I didn't grow up with a lot of material wealth or a ton of cash. The personal poverty I'm discussing here isn't to present some kind of humility or to try and be better than a lot of people. I've always struggled with finances because of autism and dyspraxia, and I was always helped by my close family. And this would always make me disagree with Christians being blessed, fortunate, and to be envied, even in my time at Springs Church Master's Commission. During my time at Springs, I had to sell the car that I inherited from my uncle, and I took the bus to the big megachurch for half of the year. And the thing I'm always thankful for, though, is that someone from class would give me a ride to either St. Anne's Road or downtown so I could catch a bus to get home. And now that person's obsessed with MAGA. When I started attending Calvary Temple, busing between home and church, it was easy, and the friends that I made there also were folks without cars. When I had these friends, we would always talk about how we had each other and that we wouldn't need vehicles because we have Jesus. But slowly, over time, each friend I had got married and they had to get a car because they were having kids. And at first, this made me very upset, but it also made me understand something. When you're working with dependents, it's a sign of privilege that someone can use a big resource like a car just to stay alive, especially in medical situations involving hospital visits and mothers in labor. But for those of us who like walking everywhere, those of us who need time to meditate while riding public transit, those of us married couples who choose not to have a nuclear family, and those of us who actually can't drive without having a meltdown like myself, it just gets annoying when Christians who have cars, they pull up beside you after a church service in a nice brisk summer or spring or fall day with no rain, and then encourage you to get in their car so they can drop you off somewhere. And look, here's the thing. Number one, I don't need charity. I need a walk. I need exercise. And I need to regulate my neurodivergent brain after listening to a sermon with tons of information. And because I'm an introvert, I need that alone time. Number two, some Christians who do this, Christian car owners, they see a pedestrian walking from church and they're going for lunch or they're going to take the bus home, and they try to give rides to people who walk because they think that pedestrians are potentially in danger of poor people who could rob them easily, which there's a less chance of that happening in a car, according to them. And number three, Christians also give rides just to add another notch to their reasons why God should let them into heaven. It's selfish virtue signaling, in my opinion. Now, I know in some cases that Christians mean well when they want to give a ride. And sometimes, especially when I lived in Brandon where there was no Sunday bus service, I am very thankful that I got lifts on cold Januarys when I walked to church for an hour in minus 40 Celsius. But damn, it is frustrating. It is frustrating dealing with evangelicals upholding car culture, which emphasizes personal freedom and convenience while supporting shallow values of individualism. So what if you're a big church that wants to be a mobile so-called collective congregation? If it's a nice day out, The sun is shining, there's no rain. Let me get my Fitbit steps in and keep driving. Maybe then you'll realize that this is how I treat my body like a temple while your fat ass pollutes the environment with gas. Okay, I need to calm down. Let's take a trip back down memory lane to 1999. In 99, a few months before the whole Y2K thing, my parents took precautions early, and they decided to hoard a bunch of food and toilet paper. You remember what that was like in 2020, right? Well, this happened in 99 when I was 16 years old. After another blunder of falling for the satanic panic of the world ending, my parents eventually found out and accepted that Y2K was only a computer bug that was a potential glitch in how computers process dates. During that time, though, there were a lot of odd people walking down Portage Avenue near the bay, and they blended in with the indigenous people begging for food, and this guy with a bunch of tracts and a Bible, he came up to me, started preaching what I already knew while I rolled my eyeballs in the back of my head. But he put exclusive emphasis on Jesus coming back because of Y2K, and he started freaking out in complete certainty when I just wanted to go get a new shirt from the store down the street. And of course, while I knew in the back of my head that Jesus was coming back soon, I also questioned it. I never really rapped about it when I was a nationalist hip hopper. And I knew that life was going to be over when it actually did happen. The thing is, I had dreams I wanted to live. Back then, I wanted to make sure the nation was completely conservative before the world ended. I didn't want to just get beamed up to the front of the throne room and praise God for eternity. I wanted to sell my CDs. I wanted to date someone. I wanted to travel across the world. I wanted to show my high school I was all that in a bag of chips before graduating. And of course, obviously that never happened, but I just didn't want to leave this life. And when I actually wrote Christian rap, I simply said, Jesus is coming back soon, but you don't have to be afraid. I never said much after that. I didn't get all obsessed with judgments and revelation. I mean, even in my collaboration, in a song with two other rappers, it was called The Second Coming, I was talking about how cool God would be when he comes back, not all the crazy judgment and shit. Anyway, after the whole world moved on from the Y2K thing, I saw that same dude while I was going down Portage again. He was in front of the bay, preaching his ass off again. But he had a totally different message. That's the thing, the goalposts move. And that's the problem with futuristic bullshit interpretations of Revelation. If you live long enough, you will always see people preaching that Jesus is coming back, or that the end of the world is gonna happen again at a different date. There's a preacher named Harold Camping who wrote a book called 1994 with a question mark on it. It covered a wide range of so-called evidence proving that Jesus was coming back in September. And when the date came and went in September of 1994, and there were no changes, nothing happened, nobody disappeared, nobody floated into the air, he said that Christ was coming back on May 21st, 2011. And then, of course, he wrote an article saying that it was impossible to predict Christ's return before he died. I mean, come on! The Bible actually says no one knows the day or the hour, so maybe we should just move on with our lives and take it one day at a time. I understand if people are so unhappy with the state of things that they feel hopeless and suicidal, but as an alternative, why do people actually give into the crazy idea of rapture and want Jesus to come back? Alright, so some of the believers that are listening to this right now, you know, they're listening with judgment or they're going to try and debunk this particular episode. I don't care what you do with it. Download it, do whatever you want. It's Creative Commons, y'all. Some of these believers, they're hearing this and they're going to hate what I'm about to say, but I'm just going to say it anyway because I'm that kind of guy, dear listener. That's the thing about being autistic. Christians subconsciously don't want to face the fact that heaven is the very, very last reason that Christians want Jesus to come back. Some of the real reasons are reasons even I used to have for wanting Jesus to come back. I actually didn't care about being raptured or going to heaven. I wanted to be alive and on earth to see the drama. I wanted to see the judgment upon people I didn't like. I wanted to watch systems fail and fall. I wanted to watch rivers of blood flow into the streets. I actually longed to be down on a street corner watching God pour out his wrath and let the devil turn the earth into a living hell. With me witnessing it all, I wanted to see cars crash, dishes break, earthquakes split the earth before being whisked away like dust after Thanos snapped his fingers. But eventually, the more I kept on going to church in my late 20s, the more I read the Bible, the more I actually studied Revelation, I had to deal with the trauma that I could possibly be the one who's judged. Just because I didn't believe that being rich, having a car, taking personal responsibility, or working hard led to being blessed. I had to deal with feelings that because a Christian girl didn't want to marry me, she thought I was weird because I was autistic or whatever, and that I'll never be good enough. And I had to deal with the thought of never measuring up just because I didn't support Trump or Stephen Harper or Pierre Poilievre, just because they're the Christians in government. Like, I felt like if I disagreed publicly about these things, I felt ultimate rejection. Eventually, I came to a realization that tons of people are suffering from fear, self-hatred, and massive anxiety just because of the fact that they don't feel holy enough to go to heaven, and they don't feel like they have the requirements to avoid God's judgment when he comes back. See, the thing is that it never occurs to evangelicals who want Jesus to come back now that they don't want to see the outcomes of a global traumatic act, such as a third of the world disappearing. Just watching the responses of churches like Springs and Cheyenne's congregations and how they dealt with COVID is big fucking proof that they're full of fucking fear and not faith. And they cry about their kids having fucking mental health issues because of benign restrictions when most of our mental health problems come from fucking rich real estate moguls, governments, Wall Street, Jeff Rich out of the wazoo, Bezos, asshole Elon, Zuck, and other people who run the system stealing the proletariat's fucking money. It's capitalism. It's capitalism that's the root cause of many mental breakdowns, and Christians only care about how much privilege their little group gets while ensuring their entitled bigoted churches stay open and pump out right-wing bullshit from the pulpits while a killer cold so-called keeps them from getting their haircuts, going to Chick-fil-A, getting together to the party with beer and wine, meeting in men's retreats to play with guns, watch UFC, wrestle in mud, and prep for a civil war while women meet, drink coffee, and do weird Christian things that women do, like talk about books and purity culture shit. And the ironic thing is that they all swear that Jesus is going to rapture them from their weird lives full of moral panics of endless earth-draining consumerism. And they will buy into this shit, even though they surround themselves with the things that pretty much any reasonable, superior being would actually hate. I mean, this is what they think is going to happen. Christians will be listening to music by Kanye West, and then they get taken to be with the Lord. How about committing adultery with a best friend's spouse and then getting raptured? They actually think that they'll be able to go through this. Even with forgiveness theology, how in the hell does the expectation that they can live in hedonism be forgiven, and then they go to heaven? And that doesn't make sense. Sometimes I believe that rapture theology is created as both a means for control and an excuse to commit the ultimate selfish act. A selfish act of wanting to experience heaven, the glory of God, the protection of angels, and all the blessings of earth like cars and cruises right now, while everyone else they say they love is left to suffer miserably like vermin on earth. And then Christians can gloat and they can be like, oh, I tried to tell you, praise God, praise God, praise him, I'm going to heaven, and it's too late to come with me later, God hater. And this whole thing prevails and even influences rich people to push for a bigger race war. It pushes them to build bunkers and stockpile weapons and follow whoever they believe to be the next president in 2024 so they can go no holds bar and wipe the inferior non-believers clean off the Earth's surface. They have to consume everything while stockpiling weapons that they've been saving and take a bunch of online courses with paramilitary skills training just so they can be part of the action. Christians are playing into the consumerist psyop of the world ending because they know that their American Christianity is going to fucking die. Most people want Christ to return, but they want him to return just so they can look at everyone they think is wrong or they think is impure and say, "I told you so." Period. That's what this is about. Many evangelical Christians, they will go to the ends of the earth, even on money burning mission trips, just to prove that they're correct all along. And to join them, we need to so-called think for ourselves, quote unquote, so we can come to our own conclusions that they're right and we're wrong. And because they are right, they deserve everything the world has to offer. Everything. While everyone like me, who isn't as rich, or who isn't able-bodied, or who isn't blessed, or who isn't neurotypical, suffers and dies. Life and life more abundantly for everyone? Ha! None for us! It's freedom for you, even while you commit all the seven deadly sins, while allowing your so-called freedom to be a prison for me and everyone else you don't think is pure, straight, non-autistic, or white. Christians can desire justification for trying their best, for trying to hold back all of their lust for money, fame, and someone to bang in a random broom closet. They can pray and try to manifest that dream vacation to be with family before the rapture happens, and I'm okay with that. But people believing in a god or religion just to be a good person while consuming and participating in hedonism and capitalism while wanting an omnipotent being's forgiveness? Give me a break. And that's the message. The presumption that wanting Christ's return makes someone a super godly person covers up how truly selfish, futurist, end-of-the-world Christians are. It covers up their need to live an abundant life on Earth right now. And this kind of Christianity is going to pretty much kill the American church before the world gets swallowed up by famines, black oily oceans, forests turning to complete ash by fire, icebergs completely evaporating into the oceans, and a disappearing ozone layer. Consumerist Christians and the rich, they actually subconsciously want the world to end. And the way they steal, kill, and destroy everything they can eat to satisfy their sin of gluttony will be what brings civilization to its knees. That's how the world's gonna truly end. And we are already experiencing some of that right now. There, I said it. Just like other Christians who are constantly saying the quiet part out loud these days.